Well, it has been great to be here. I'm talking like it's over, but it is almost over. I was just telling the sister in the back that when you enjoy being among people, it doesn't take long for it to seem like it just flew by, and it's over. And I've enjoyed being here. Patty's enjoyed being here. And if you know me, if you knew me better, you'd know that I really enjoy her being here too. But I have a confession to make before we start this evening. That is, I've been so depressed today. I have been. I've been almost morose over this. I just found out yesterday that I'm old. And that's just kind of playing on my mind. And then I read something today. It said there's three things that happen to you when you get old. And one of them is that you lose your memory. I can't remember the other one. But I got some insight in that, because what I think is that I will soon forget that I'm old and it'll be okay. Tonight we're going to talk about This Is My Father's World. And as we suggested last night at the close of our service, and as we talked about what we were going to talk about this evening, I believe that it is right and proper to use the avenue of evidential apologetics in teaching about the existence of God. We live in a society today that denies God almost on every turn. And don't make any mistake about it, those who promote the theory, and that's what it is, a theory, the theory of evolution, it is inherently a denial of the existence of God. And it's all right for us to look at the evidence and to come to a different conclusion than that what they say the evidence points to. Paul used the natural world in his presentation on Mars Hill in Athens. Remember, he was among the philosophers. These were the guys that thought they were real well educated, and they came together to discuss philosophy and have different ideas about this and that. Turn your Bibles to Acts 17. And let's read a little bit about this account. Take some mental notes as we read this section, beginning in verse 22 of Acts 17. Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim unto you." Isn't that neat? I mean, I look at that and I'm just rather amazed. Paul walks through and he takes advantage of an opportunity. Here they have all these idols and they have all these objects of worship, and here's one in which, just in case they missed one, they inscribe it unto the unknown God. He said, "Now you admit that you have an unknown God. Let me tell you about him, because that's the very one that you need to know about." Isn't that a wise use of an opportunity? "Him I proclaim unto you, God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life and breath and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being." Now, do you see what he did there? They had a God for everything. They had a God for fertility and for rain and for harvest and for crops and for, you know, headaches and toothaches and toe aches and so on. They had a God for everything. And he says, "I found this one that you inscribe to the unknown God." And then do you notice that he ascribes everything to that one God that they didn't know about? He's the Lord of heaven and earth. He did the creation. He does the providings. He does the limitations. That's what he does. God made the world and everything in it. That's the one I'm proclaiming it to you. He's the Lord of the heaven and the earth. He has the authority over everything. That's what he means when he talks about him being Lord. He has the authority over the heaven and the earth. And he is not limited, as these gods that you have created are, to a physical temple built by men. And he gives life and breath and all things, and made from one blood every nation of men. And so he's saying all descended from one. You want to know where man came from? They all descended from one. That's an allusion back to the very beginning, you see. and he determined their pre-appointed times. I'm not sure that I know exactly what that means, but I think it's probably pointing to the limit of their national powers. And the next one is the boundaries of their dwellings, maybe the boundaries of their national territories. And whether I'm right about that or not, if I look back in history, I see God has always limited that. You notice that? Nations will rise and they'll become sometimes called empires, and they'll have a large amount of the earth in which they'll have control over, but then they'll fade away. If we go back in the Old Testament during the time of Isaiah, who was in power? Assyria. 130 years later, who's in power? Well, Syria has faded from existence, and now Babylon's in power. Okay? And then by the end of the prophecies of Jeremiah and the end of the discussion of things in the book of Daniel, where's Babylon? They're gone. The Persians are in power. He set the limits to their dwellings. And then again in Romans chapter 1, we have to keep moving because we've got a lot to say in the lesson this evening. Look in Romans chapter 1, and again we find him using these apologetics, this form of apologetics, in order to make a point to people. How do we get the chart up here? You'd think after a week I'd know how, but you've always done it for me. You didn't really show me how.
Like that.
Okay, just from the beginning, huh? Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way mine is. But my screen doesn't look like that. Okay. Romans chapter 1, verse 15. He says, so much as is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are in Rome. This is the Apostle Paul speaking. And he says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hinder the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known of God is manifest in them, for God has manifested it unto them. For the invisible things of him since the creation of the world are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, even his everlasting power and divinity, that they may be without excuse. Now, how might we say that in today's language? You can see God in all his creation. Take a look. You know what he's inviting them to do? Look closely. Take a closer look. Because that, knowing God, he says, verse 21, they glorified him not as God, neither gave thanks, but became vain in their reasonings, and their senseless heart was darkened. So here they had the opportunity. The evidence was there. If they examined it or remembered even from the beginning, they would know it, but they had rejected it, and therefore their heart was darkened. They didn't see. Sound like anybody today? Well, you can figure that out for yourself. But God made himself known to man is the point. The invisible things of him, of God, are clearly seen in the creation. And that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to look at God's world and see that God is indelibly etched upon the things that his hand is there upon the things that he made. And he is perceived through the things that are made. And it does demonstrate his everlasting power and divinity, or as the King James says there, his Godhead, or his and Godhood. There are a lot of other references. If you're taking notes, just jot down quickly John chapter 1, 1 through 3. And there, John, as he introduces his gospel, says that the Word, Jesus Christ, who became flesh, was a participant in the creation. And the Hebrew writer makes the same claim in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. And if you go back to Genesis and you read, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. People say, see, just one. You know that's the plural form of God in Genesis 1, verse 1? It incorporates all of the Godhead that participated in the creation. We want to take a limited look this evening at the book of nature. We have the inspired, revealed scriptures that we can look into and that we trust and that we have confidence in, and when we read we know it's the Word of God. But he has another book that he gave. And the other book that he gave is the book of nature. And what Paul is saying is, read it. Examine it. Look at it. And you can see. So we want to take a limited look. And I'll tell you, we could talk about this for months and it would still be a limited look. And we're not going to look at it for months, only for a couple of days. Did you bring lunch? Oh, no, we'll move on. But his creation is magnificent. And if we cannot see the intelligent design of our omnipotent God in his creation, we have been blinded by the God of this world. We have been blinded by that. Paul talks about that kind of blinding in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. But we want to take just a brief look here this evening at the earth and heavens and some animal in the animal kingdom and briefly at the human body and then draw a few conclusions at the end of our lesson this evening. I want you to consider the earth and heavens for a little bit. If you're an 8-year-old boy, just looks out at the sky in the evening, you might think that there's no kind of design or order to what you look up in the sky. And if you keep yourself from being informed at all, you might even do that by the time you're 40 years old. But you also might, before very long, look up and notice that there are certain stars in a certain place at a certain time. And they have a certain, they seem to have a certain design to them. We call them constellations, you see. We might notice, a long time before we're 8 years old, I hope, that it gets dark every night. And it gets light every morning. And that happens on a consistent and regular basis. And if we pay a whole close attention, we'll find out it's really regular, even as to time, is when that's going to happen. So it's not random. The earth is not just. And we learn things over time. You know, there people used to think that there was a great big muscular guy that held the earth on his shoulder. Did you know that? I think some pictures I see has it on his left shoulder, and some have it. It's in the middle of his back. But that's how the earth is held up. And so we might have some wrong ideas about things we see, but when we think about it, we'll find out that the earth is not just randomly scattered somewhere in the universe. It's just boom, there. And just by happenstance, it's wherever it is, and there's no relationship to any of the other bodies in the heavens around it, that it just happens to be there, because that's not so. You know, the earth is placed exactly the right distance from the sun, so that it won't be neither too hot or too cold. And if we were very much closer, we'd burn up. And if we were very much further away, we'd freeze. But it's the right distance away. And it's in the right spot. And it's within a magnetic field that protects us from harmful radiation. Even the tilt of the earth, 23.5 degrees, even the tilt of the earth is ideal to regulate heat. If it's tilted, let's say, to 45 degrees, the summers would be too hot. And the winters would be too cold. And if this angle was decreased from 23.5 degrees, then it would be too hot at the equator and much too cold at the poles. Pretty cold up there already. Guess we wouldn't want any colder than that. And the mass of the earth itself is just right to create the proper gravitational pull that is to hold on to a life-sustaining atmosphere gases about us. It's just right to hold it there. You know, you can't go up to the moon and breathe. Or to some other planet and breathe. But for the earth, it's just as it ought to be. And this life on earth requires liquid water. The earth sits at just the right distance from the sun to allow water to flow as, as a liquid. And 3/4 of the earth, roughly, is covered by water. Do you know that no other planet is known to have this life-giving fluid? Did you know that? Do you ever notice that when you're reading, hearing the science portion of the news, or you're reading in science magazines, how every now and then you'll find this article about how they think that they see on Mars what looks like the tracks made by water, or the residuals of a pool of water, or the, you know, what they're wanting to do is be able to say, well, there was water up there. If it's not there now, there was. And if they have water, you know why they're so interested in trying to establish water somewhere else? Because life can't exist without water. I was reading an article the other day that was not written by a Christian. He didn't have any desire in the article to prove any creation theory. But what he did note, he says, mathematically, it is impossible for life to exist anywhere but on the earth. And he gave, I can't go into all the details of that. It's a big old long formula that he gave and how it worked out. But his point was, is that, you know, it's so improbable that it's impossible. We don't know water anywhere else. The earth has just the right chemicals to sustain life. About 99% of the universe is made up of hydrogen and helium, at least as far as we know. That's what it's made up of. The earth is different. It's made up of the heavier elements which can form compounds that are essential to life. Why is that? The earth has a large moon that lights the night while regulating the tides and keeping the seas from becoming stagnant. Until I started doing research and evidence, I knew that it regulated the tides, but I didn't really realize that if there weren't tides, you know, if you go out in the farm pond and you see one that hasn't had been stirred around very much and it's not very deep, and what happens to it? You want to get your, you know, water with your lunch out of that pond? See? Because it becomes stagnant, doesn't it? But the tides keep that from happening in the ocean. Isaiah wrote, turn to Isaiah 45. Isaiah wrote in Isaiah 45 and verse 18 that the earth was specially designed by God to be inhabited. Isaiah 45:18. For thus saith the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited, I am the Lord, and there is no other. Now that's about as clear as you can be, isn't it? Pretty hard to mistake that. I formed the earth, I made the earth for the purpose of it being inhabited. And so it is. All right? How about plants? Plants have always interested me, even from the time I was very young. And, of course, the teacher was always talking about chloroform and oxygen and carbon dioxide, and that kind of interested me. Plants are energy processors, if you please. They absorb the energy from the sun and they convert it to usable energy for other living things. So they produce food. They grow so the rabbit can eat it. They grow so the cow can have something to eat. You see, they produce food. They produce oxygen. That's what we need to live. We have to have oxygen. You breathe in oxygen, and then you breathe out carbon dioxide. And can you live in carbon dioxide? No, the plants take the carbon dioxide. They need that, and they convert it back to oxygen. They have a function. They provide homes for animals, and they retard erosion, and they retain moisture. There are a lot of purposes that are accomplished through plants. Plants testify of God's wisdom and His provision. In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 30, we read there, "Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food." And it was so. It wasn't here by happenstance. God put it here so it could feed the animals. I'd give it to them for food. How about the sun? You think the sun is the largest body in the heavens? But it looks the largest to us because it's closer to us. I'm told there are at least six within seeing distance that are larger than the sun. But they don't function like the sun does for us. They don't do that for us. The Lord said the sun was to rule the day. And it does. My wife does not want the sun ruling the day too early, so she puts real dark screens on the window, and she wants to wake up when she's ready to wake. But I like to be up and see the sun begin its rule of the day. But I'll tell you what, at least when the clouds aren't out, it permeates everything, doesn't it? The sun shines everywhere. It's to rule the day. It's to give light upon the earth. It's to mark the signs and the season. And it's unique in the fact that its ideal in size to support life on earth is not too small, it's not too big, it's not too far away, and it's not too close. And it's an extremely efficient energy source of constant energy, in fact. I'm told, and I don't know how they know all these things, they're just smarter than me. But they tell me that every second the sun produces enough energy to run a billion major cities for a year. We don't even have a billion major cities. We don't even have a billion minor cities. Okay? Well, if we could figure out how to harness that, our oil crisis would be over, wouldn't it? But it has a lot of energy. How about the stars? You look up in the sky when I go out at my house in the wintertime, that's when you can see the stars the best. You can see quite a few stars. But there's residual lights from the nearby towns and cities, and that kind of keeps us from being able to really see the stars. My wife and I went out west last year where we could be where there weren't any major cities. In fact, there weren't any minor cities some places we were. And when it got dark at night, you could look in the sky. I had no idea there were so many stars that you could see with the naked eye. The sky is just filled with them. But you know what? You can't see them all with the naked eye. Can't even come close. We are told, at least, that we're part of a galaxy of stars called the Milky Way, and it is estimated to number over 100 billion stars in that galaxy. Now, I don't know who counted them. Okay? But what they do know, there's a lot of them. And they can't count them. And they also claim that there is an estimated 100 billion galaxies. I mean, a billion is a lot. We all know that. Maybe our president and Congress don't know a billion's a lot, but a billion's a lot to us, isn't it? The stars were created to light the night, to mark the passage of time, and for another purpose, to declare the glory of God. To declare God's glory. In Genesis 1 and verse 16, we read there that God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And he set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw it was good. The psalmist said in Psalms 19 and verse 1, he said, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. And when I read about what people are able to discover about the heavens and what is in there, it does declare his handiwork. The brilliance of God. And it's almost like, here's the earth and all the wonderful things on the earth, and you can look up and only see so much of it. And then God did all this wonderful other stuff that is beyond our ability even to see. And it declares us anywhere. There was no, you know what it says? No limit to it. Look what he did. It shows the awesome power of our Almighty God. That's what it does. In Psalms 147 and verse 4, it says, he counted the number of the stars and he calls them by name. Now, I don't know about how many billion there are, but there's a lot more there than I could write names down for and remember. He said, he calls them by name. A similar idea is given in Isaiah chapter 40 in verse 26. There they're called hosts instead of stars. But in Psalms 19, in Psalms 147, they're called stars. All right? Well, let's move on from that. What about the animal world? There are more than a million different known species and organisms known to inhabit the earth. And about 70% of those are animals. And the scope of their numbers and diversity is just truly remarkable. So many things out there. Even a drop of salt water carries with it a menagerie, an impressive zoo of things that are in that water that we normally don't see. When I was in Romania a few years ago, I drank some water, and then a little bit later, I looked into a white pool of water with porcelain, and I could see things moving around in that water. Yeah. I was wishing I hadn't drank any by then. And believe me, I paid the price for that too. a little bit later. But, things are in there. And even a little drop of water. But in each thing that God made, we take the time to look, we see the awesome power of design that God has given. And, He's designed things to meet the challenge of everyday existence. Things work together. They intend to accomplish things together. And many things are dependent upon other things that exist. And we're certainly dependent on many other things that exist for our own existence. The scriptures, brethren, echo across every hillside, desert, and plain. For within them are the precepts of order and design that are inherent throughout the animal kingdom. And the fingerprints of God are indelibly printed upon these things and indelibly etched upon them. We can see God's handprint in the creation that He makes. And observation of these things, I believe, will bring a new sense of wonder. The closer we look, the more impressed we are. At least the closer I look, the more impressed I am. The writer of Job says, I put this passage on the chart. He said, but now ask the beast, and they will teach you. And the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. And the fish of the sea will explain to you. Who among all these do not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of everything and the breath of all mankind? Seems to me that he's saying, of all the creation, maybe man is the only one who doesn't know where it came from. See? But he said, ask the beast, and he will tell you. Ask the earth, and it will tell you. He's saying, look at them, and you will discover what God has done. So let's look at a handful of illustrations from the animal world that will teach us. And we want to ask as we go, how could the complexities of these things simply have evolved? How could they just happen? All right? Look at the spider. How many of you like spiders? Interesting thing, the scripture says that spiders dwelt even in kings' palaces. They couldn't keep them out, is the idea. Okay? Somebody says, I got a spider in the house. Yeah, and so does everybody else, for that matter. Because that's the way spiders are, okay? But the spider, do you know that the spider, this one just has a bit of web that it's hanging on. You know spiders spin their web perfectly the first time and every time? Mama spider didn't say, now come here, Junior, let me show you how this is done. First time, every time, all right? Their fibers, these fibers, are more durable by weight than steel. And stronger. You ever heard of Kevlar? They use that in the protecting the soldiers with their bulletproof vest. Stronger than that. Stronger than that. Oh, it doesn't look that because it's so small, but you get it all together, guess what you have? That kind an equal weight of strength. What could have promoted such evolution, and how could they have survived without this before they evolved it? Okay. Here's a neat one. Anybody know what that is? Well, I got it on the chart. Now you know what it is. It's an archer fish. You know what archer fish do? They come from Malaysia. Archer fish, you see this fish, we have a pointer here. Well, never mind. You see this one? The white line is the top of the water. You see the little bubbles going up there, children? See what that is? What an archer fish does is it goes up there and it sees a bug up to 4 feet out of the water on a branch, and it shoots the water up there and it hits the bug and knocks it down in the water, and then it grabs it like a trout and eats it. But it can't get up there 4 feet to get the bug, so it shoots water up there. You know what the problem is here? Anybody know what the problem is? You know what it is, Patrick? You ever heard of refraction? Yeah. You know what refraction is? If you're fishing and you see this trout over there you want to catch, and you think it's right there where Joe's shoe is, and you... it's not there, it's down here. Because refraction makes it look like it's there when it's somewhere. That fish has the same problem. There's refraction. It's able to overcome that refraction and hit with accuracy that bug. How's he do that? Isn't that amazing? It is amazing to me. How about bats? How many like bats? How many like to shoot bats? Just testing you out because there's a thousand, huh?
Hard to shoot.
They're hard to shoot. Have you tried it? Better not tell me. There's a $1,500 fine in Pennsylvania and a $1,000 fine in West Virginia for shooting bats. They're trying to protect them because of all of the good things that bats accomplish in keeping bugs away from us. But you know how they pursue their prey? The bugs that they catch, the gnats and the bugs and whatever they get? Radar. A sophisticated form of radar, and they're able to accurately detect the size and the distance and even the texture and the relative velocity to the target. And think about it. You say, oh, no, that can't be. It can't catch the bug without knowing those things. You see? It has to know those things. And it is so accurate that in some species of bats, that they can tell with their radar whether a ripple on the surface of a lake is a leaf that has fallen there or a fish that has broken the surface of the water. Did you know some bats fish like eagles? Yeah, they do. Not all bats, but some bats. Do you find that interesting? I do. Here's one that I really like. Honeybees. And I like that illustration because we got the worker bee and we got the messenger bee. See? Now, the messenger bee, he goes out and he finds some nectar, some sugar water, some food for the hive. And he runs back to the hive and he says, "Hey Joe, guess what I found? Come on, follow me. Hey, keep up, because is that how he does it?" Well, that's what I used to think. That's what a lot of people used to think. He just came back and gave a message. But that's not... He does give the message, but it's a lot more complicated than that. If you ever talk to Brother Mike Cox out in Wisconsin, he knows all about bees. You learn a lot from him about bees. But the messenger bee, he does go find the food source. And it might be a mile away or half a mile away. And he flies back to the hive. And he does say, "Hey guys, I found some food." Okay? But you know how he tells them that? First of all, he takes samples of the food and he passes them out. He passes out samples. And he passes them out, and now they got to know where it is though. And what he does is he does a little dance in the hive that buzzes and turns. If you saw this, I wanted to have this on film because it's really interesting. Ever seen it? They buzz and waggle, and it tells them what kind it is, how far it is, the wind speed and velocity it takes to get to it so that they won't be sheared off course by the wind, and the direction. Gives them all kind of information about this food source. And by the way, the messenger bee that comes back, he only tells people in his colony of bees, not the whole hive, just those that he's responsible for. How do they know that? They've done extensive experiments where they marked the messenger bee and the colony bees and done that for four, in fact, the study that I looked at, for four different colonies in the same hive. And when they checked where the bees went, not a single bee from another colony went to that, to the wrong food source. Isn't that amazing? That is amazing in bees. They do this little dance, this little wiggle-waggle kind of thing. The number of buzzes tell them the intensity, where, all kind of information in that. Why are honeybees important? Well, they're important because we just learned something. It causes us to see the amazing power of God. But they're pollinators. They are the major pollinators in the world. Did you know that? They're the major pollinators in the world. In West Virginia and Pennsylvania, I don't know how it is up here, but we've been having some kind of disease that has gotten among the bees, and our agricultural department in West Virginia is extremely concerned about that. They've been working feverishly for 2 or 3 or 4 years now trying to figure out what is the problem, because we can't afford to lose our bees. So they're trying to find what is it that's killing the bees, because we're not going to have apples and pears and grapes and cherries and whatever, and corn. That'll go out of existence if we don't keep things pollinated. So they have to be concerned about that. Here's another one. Monarch butterflies. You know what milkweed is? Do you have monarchs up here? I don't know if you get up this far east and this far north if you do. But if you have monarch butterflies, you also have milkweed. And you know how I know that? Because monarch butterflies only feed on milkweed. They only lay their eggs and larvae on milkweed. That's all they lay on. Milkweed is poison. But they eat it. They're immune to it, these butterflies. But another interesting thing about these butterflies is that the ones that are born early in the spring, they go about their business and they do their thing and they lay their eggs and they die. Okay? But the ones born late in the year live 6 times longer than the ones born early. Live 6 times longer. And they go, does anybody know where they go for the winter? They go to Mexico. If they're east of the Rockies, and if they're west of the Rockies, they go to California. And they go there by the millions. And they go down there in winter. Now the ones born in the springs are not the one that goes to Mexico. And the ones that go to Mexico and winter over are not the ones that come back. How do they know to do that? What mechanism kicks in that says this one's going to live 6 times longer than the first one? You think there's design there somewhere? Here's one. The children, I think, will enjoy this. The duck-billed Australian platypus. Kind of a weird thing, isn't it? Has fur like a beaver. And it has a bill like a duck and web feet like a duck. It has venomous spurs like a snake. It has cheek pouches like a squirrel. It has legs parallel to the ground like a lizard. It lays eggs like a bird. That's kind of all mixed up, isn't it? Doesn't it seem like it's all mixed up? From what type of animal did the platypus evolve? From a mammal? Well, mammals don't lay eggs. From a lizard? Well, lizards don't have fur. From a duck? Well, ducks don't nurse their young. From a snake. But snakes don't have webbed feet. From a squirrel or a monkey. But squirrels don't have duck bills. And we've got all kind of problems there. It really seems to be a combination of them all. Maybe it shows that God had a sense of humor. He confounded with the duck-billed platypus the wisdom of the wise. How can you get this all in? Our illustrations, good people, could be multiplied thousands of times in everything. I had so many illustrations I had to say, I'm just going to put these down and we're only going to talk about a few. Man, I like to talk about the giraffe. 18 foot tall, got a 2.5 foot heart, and it's got this big tall head. What happens, it's up there with this heart pumping this blood up into his head, and he wants a drink of water. Boom, he drops his head, and what happens to him? This big strong heart blows his brains out. God designed in him a system of valves that close down as he drops his head. And then there's a spongy substance at the base of his brain that kind of keeps the blood in there that they need while they're getting that drink. And if he happens to look right or left and there's this a lion attacking him and he whips up his head ready to run, what happens to you if you're down looking on the floor and you jump up real quick? Well, what if it happened to the giraffe when the lion's after him? But God made plan for that. That blood that's in that spongy thing, that takes care of that until the heart regulates the blood right, and he's off and running. He's going fine. Well, like I said, we got a lot of those illustrations, so we better move on. Science and technology for a long time have looked into the animal kingdom for inspiration and design. How do you think men learned how to fly? They observed birds, didn't they? And submarines. What did they observe to see? Whales, to see how do whales function? And how are dams built? They still study today beavers to see how is it that these little animals can take these relatively not strong materials and make these wonderfully strong dams. And the looking at design in the animal world has led to all kind of invention. Where they got the idea for radar? Bats. That's where they got the idea. All right. British naturalist John Ray structured in his Discourse on Animal Physiology and Behavior around these thoughts, and I just thought I'd quote them to you. He says, "The vast multitude of creatures, both small and immensely great, are effective proof of God's almighty power. Let us then consider the worth of God and observe the operation of his hands. Let us admire his infinite wisdom and his goodness in the formation of them, reflecting upon their great architect, and give him the praise and the glory that is due him." Look at the design and praise the designer, is what he's saying. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. The human body is composed of 11 major organs, and when we get this all covered and understand it, we'll be done. No, we won't. We won't be done. No, we're not going to cover it all. What I hope, and just look at that quickly. But these organ systems are designed to work together simultaneously. In fact, they must work together this way. And they're designed to work in perfect harmony. God intends for these all to work together. And it does an amazingly good job of it, doesn't it? What we'll do is we'll pick out a time when it doesn't, or when it actually begins to wear out, which it always does. That's why we end up dying. But look how long it works. How about the pump of our heart? I was going to go into that, but we'll go into a lot of detail on that. But you just think about it. Here's a 3/4 pound, a pound heart that for a lot of people beat for 70, 80 years, pumping millions of gallons of blood through the body. And, you know, until we might go to the doctor and he says, you know, you're starting to have a little hiccup in your heart, we don't even think about it, do we? It just goes on and on and on. God designed this pump. I mean, do you know a pump that a man has made that will work for 70 years without repair? Think about that. Think about the psalmist said, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And we look at the very act of conception and what it ends up being and how quickly it works, and the multiple cells that begin with just two things, and in just merely hours what has happened, and then in merely days what has happened, and these two things that get together and begin the embryo have all the information stamped within them that tells them, you know, what color you'll be, what color your eyes will be, whether you'll be a male or a female. It's all in there. It has a lot to do with your characteristics. What you know, all that you'll look like in the genetic code. And it has instructions in that code that says this part will become eyes, and this part will become kidneys, and this part will become fingers, and this part will become, and it puts it in the right place too. And these different organs are different kinds of flesh. Okay? Your heart and liver are not the same. And so on and so forth. Men in recent years have been able to insert cameras and look at the growth of children in the womb of mothers, but a long time before modern technology allowed that. I want you to see what David said in Psalms 139. He says, "For you created my innermost being, you knit me together," being in verse 13, "you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body, and all the days ordained me were written in your book before one of them came to be." The plan was there, and it was fulfilled. Think about how the body functions, and we'll just... There's more of those, but we can talk about that more. You can just research more. But the body has a defense system, and it works for a long time and all the time right. And I know we get sick, go to the doctor, something's out of order. But I'll tell you what, you cut your finger. Mike Leo knows about that. I'll tell you what happened when he cut his finger. Instantly, there were millions of white blood cells that hurried to that part of his body to begin to fight off and stave off infection. And those are renewed. You know, your blood wears out and is replaced by new blood. They got all kind of names for it. We're not going into that tonight. But it's replaced. God designed it that way. Designed for our bodies to heal. And on and on and on. Look at how things function. Look at your eye. Does the eye impress you? Do we not have some really wonderful cameras out there? You know, they still don't make a camera that can work the aperture like the eye does. They talk about this camera can see 3 million different colors. And this printer can print, you know, 32 million colors. You know how many colors the eye can see? No, you don't. They don't either. They just talk about 100 million. But when you look out and you see any shade of difference in the trees and the colors on the signs and the road, and you can see cracks in the highway, your eyes is participating in distinguishing between millions of different slight variations to see those things. Isn't that amazing? there's what's called the irreducibility argument that in against evolution. It says that if any part of one thing is taken out, it could not exist, and so you can't reduce it down. And I think it's a pretty good argument. And we can give you an illustration one really quickly. The human knee. They have determined, medically speaking, that if you just took the human knee and took any one of its parts out, it won't work. And trust me, I've had one of my parts out and it didn't work. Okay. In other words, it had to appear at once or it didn't work. Anybody ever studied wood? One more illustration. You ever watch a woodpecker? I like to go try to find these pileated woodpeckers. There's a big woodpecker with a red head and pretty good size. They make a lot of noise. And if you're a hunter and they see you, they'll tell every animal in the forest you're there. Okay. But you know, whenever a woodpecker is pecking a hole, that every time its bill hits that tree, he closes his eyes. Or she closes his eyes. Did you know that? And they can hit that several thousand times a minute. Close your eyes every time. And scientists used to think that they closed their eyes so the wood chips wouldn't fall, get in their eyes. But what they discovered was that the force in which they hit that tree is so hard that if they didn't close their eyes, they pop their eyeballs out. So they close their eyes in a special way that keeps your eyeball in. And then they finally get the hole, and some woodpeckers have 10 or 12 inch tongue. That's a pretty long tongue that they can get out of their mouth. And they got that hole in the tree, and they stick their bill down in there to get the larva of an insect that's way down there in that tree that may have, decided it wanted to be in there for several years, but now this woodpecker wants it for lunch, and he sticks his tongue down in there, and his tongue's got little barbs on the end of it to kind of spear that larva. But that may not get the job done. So guess what's on the end of the woodpecker's tongue? Glue. They manufacture a glue that sticks to the larva, pulls it back out. But now he has a gluey bug on his tongue. Now, if you want to use glue to pick something up, and you do use it and you pick it up, then what are you going to do with it? Well, you use your other hand, and now you got it in this finger, but it's still got glue on it, so it's stuck to this finger, right? Well, why doesn't the woodpecker have that problem? Because it also, as it brings that bug up, has a solvent that dissolves the glue so he can swallow the bug. Think that happened by chance? Isn't that amazing? We really have not been exhaustive in our presentation of different evidence. We might be exhausted, but we haven't been exhaustive. But I think we have presented at least adequate evidence to make the point. It's more reasonable to place our faith in an intelligent designer, Jehovah God, than to place our faith in disorganized chaos and the evolutionary theory that's presented to us. If you'll bear with me just a few moments, we'll consider a handful of what I hope you'll see to be as relevant scriptures. Paul's address to the Athenian philosophers had a spiritual purpose. And the purpose was he wanted them to think of God as living and powerful and not as an impotent idol. A God that demanded repentance. A God that who has appointed a day of judgment by which one who was resurrected from the dead, Jesus Christ. He said there'll be a day of judgment, and it will be by Jesus Christ. In Acts 17 and verse 29, he says, "Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art or man's devising. Truly, the times of this ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained. He has given assurance to this by raising him from the dead. So he didn't just want to talk about the creation. He wanted to talk about what God expected when you discovered him in the creation. There have always been foolish men who have rejected God and called it wisdom. That's not new to our generation of time. That's been true throughout time, that they've rejected God. The gospel of salvation will be veiled to those who are allowed their minds to be blinded or deceived by Satan or by evolution. In 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3, there we read, "But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the gods of this age have blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is in the image of God, should shine upon them." Keep them from seeing. I truly believe that those who espouse evolution intend to keep the light from shining on God. But you know, rejection of the truth will not negate God's judgment. If men deny God, that doesn't mean there won't be a judgment. I don't believe there'll be one, so there won't be one. No. Won't matter. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, he said, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in his body according to that which he has done, whether it's good or bad." Jesus Christ is the Lamb of God. And he came to the earth. And he's the perfect and sinless sacrifice. He was crucified. He was buried. He was resurrected. The resurrection is God's testimony of his sonship. And thus he became the atoning sacrifice for our sin. And that's what Paul's message was in both Acts 17 and Romans chapter 1. So do you believe these things? Do you confess your sins? Do you confess Christ as the Son of God? Are you willing to die with him in baptism? What Romans 6 says, we must die with him and be buried with him so we might rise to walk in newness of life. There's a poem, and it's been turned into a song. We're going to sing that song here in just a minute. But it's by Mopti Babcock, and she says, "This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings, and round me rings the music of the spheres." You know what she's saying? If you listen, you will know. Ask the beast, and they will tell you. Thank you for listening to Lesson Yours.
This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings, and round me rings the music of the spheres. This is my Father's world. I rest in the thought of rocks and trees, of skies and seas, his hand of wonders wrought. This is my Father's world. The birds their carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, Father's world.
tonight is the last night of our portion of the meeting with you. It's not the end of your work in this community. But if the Lord wills, I'd like to try to encourage you by the last sermon. And we want to talk about Be Thou Faithful Unto Death. And what that means in Scripture. And how we might be encouraged and exhorted by that.
Please be seated. Thank you, David. I like that idea of God having a second book, the book of nature. I've often marveled at nature and how it would be very difficult not to believe in a creator when we're presented with the evidence all around us. I'd like to sing number 302, Blessed Be the Tie. And following this song, we'll be led in prayer by Raymond. Number 302.
Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above. Before our Father's throne, we pour our ardent prayers, our fears, our hopes, our dreams, our wants, our comforts and our cares. We share our mutual woes, our mutual burdens there, and often for each other flows the sympathizing tear. When we asunder part, it gives us inward pain, but we shall still be joined.